Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Darren Mott. In this episode, I'll discuss women in cybersecurity with the president of the North Alabama chapter of WSIS, Stacey Bohannon. We'll discuss the current cybersecurity work environment for women, the role of WSIS in supporting the growth of women in the cybersecurity field, as well as a look into the future. Before I get to the interview, let me start with a couple of cybersecurity news items and tips and things of that nature. So the first thing, I saw an article regarding account takeovers and what happens to your money when bad guys or bad cyber actors steal your money. Could it be a business email compromise where an actor gets into the corporate email of a company and convinces someone within the finance department to wire transfer money to somewhere it's not supposed to go, or someone basically steals your identity and wire transfers money out of your account? What happens to that money once it goes? Well, because of the organized nature of cyber criminals, especially those from the Eastern Bloc companies that deal with financial theft primarily, a lot of times, once that money is gone, if it's over 24 to 48 hours, chances are you're never going to get it back. Now, it could be they had an insider at the bank that helped them wire transfer the money. It could be that the SWIFT or the internal Federal Reserve System that does wire transfers or manages those things doesn't have the correct security in place to see fraudulent charges, and necessarily they wouldn't. If someone had legitimate access to a bank account and initiated a wire transfer, chances are that wire transfer is usually going to go somewhere unless the bank has taken proactive measures to see those things, which a lot of banks have kind of started to do that now. So you do have that as an advantage, but you can't always rely on it. So a couple things to be aware of if you are a victim of this, either business-wise or personally. If you identify the wire transfer within about a day, you might be able to get your bank to reverse the charges or put a hold on it before it gets out of the country, because chances are the bad guy is not wire transferring money directly from your Bank of America account in the United States to a Russian bank somewhere. It's going to go through a couple other hops, other U.S. financial institutions to kind of launder the money before it gets to where it's ultimately designed to go. So it takes a little while for those wire transfers to occur. With business email compromise, which is a huge issue within the business community as far as bad guys getting access to email accounts and initiating wire transfers not by any kind of technical means, but they use social engineering to convince someone within the finance department or payroll department to initiate a wire transfer. If within 24 to 48 hours you identify that to occur, if you contact IC3.gov, which is the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, and you list that information and what happened, they have a pretty good track record of getting those wire transfers reversed or stopped. Now, it depends on when you call and do that, whether you'll get your money back, because there's a couple things they do when this happens. And basically, if you have the right information, they'll go and look and they'll find an account, and the bad guys are funneling money into this account from victims all over the country. So there's a certain amount of money in there waiting to be wire transferred. And if you're in the right part of the queue, you may get your money back, or there may not be enough money there for it to get back. You may get some of it back. It depends on how much money is left in there if it hasn't all wire transferred over. So in most cases, if you're over 48 hours, you are never going to get your money back. Once it leaves the country, it is unlikely in most cases that the money will be reversed from the foreign bank back to the U.S. bank. Just keep that in mind. The quicker you get on top of it and alert law enforcement or IC3.gov, the better the likelihood you can get that information reversed and get your money back. Another new news items I saw today was Microsoft has released a patch for Windows 10 that addresses 129 flaws. So what does this mean, and why am I bringing this up? Well, for any piece of technology you have, it is key that you have updates on, or you at least update your systems, because when Microsoft releases an update, when Apple releases an update to their operating system, when your Ring camera has a firmware update or releases a security patch for their camera or whatever technology you're using, the reason that security patch has been created is because they found a flaw within their technology that allows someone to do something nefarious with your device, be it your Windows machine, your Mac device, your iPhone, your iPad, your Android, pick your technology of choice. If there is a patch, there's something wrong within the system that can allow a bad guy to do something you necessarily do not want. So it is key that regardless of how much technology you have, when that window pops up and said there is an update for iPhone, you should probably do the update. Now, I certainly understand the reluctance to doing some of the iPhone ones, because sometimes the patches cause more problems than they solve. And that has to be a risk assessment you take on your own. Do I want to wait a couple weeks to see if this particular release is solid, is stable? Maybe you want to do that. If you practice good web browsing hygiene and you don't go to sites you're not supposed to or questionable sites, chances are you're not really going to be targeted or hit by anybody on your iPhone and your iPad or your other tablet device or your other Android phone or what have you. Doesn't mean it's impossible to occur, but it's chances are the likelihood is less if you practice good web browsing hygiene. So that's where you have to make that risk assessment on your own. So the question you probably have, what do I do? So what I do, I'll be honest, when an iPhone or an iPad software update comes out, I do wait a week or two before I update it to make sure that that particular patch doesn't cause bigger problems to my device than if I hadn't. So that's the approach I take. You have to make your own risk assessment. I've said this many times before. I'll say it many times again, that when you are conducting a cyber assessment for yourself, it is your risk you're dealing with. So you have to make that risk assessment yourself. Don't necessarily do exactly what I do, because maybe that doesn't work for you or you don't have the same level of risk tolerance that I do. You have to kind of come up with how to best do that on your own. My guest is Stacey Bohannon, a fellow FBI retiree and the current president of the Northern Alabama chapter of the Women in Cybersecurity Group. Stacey is currently the public affairs officer for the National Cybersecurity Operations Center in Huntsville, Alabama, and she's a proud Auburn mom. At least I assume you're a proud Auburn mom. Are you, Stacey, a proud Auburn mom?
I am. All proud Auburn moms know the phrase war eagle.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so that's the Roll Tide people just turned off the podcast, but that's okay. So we'll stick with the Auburn folks. So let's talk about your FBI career. I'm always fascinated. And usually the first question anybody ever asks me who's in the FBI is, how'd you get to the FBI? So what brought you to the FBI? Was it a lifelong dream to work for the Bureau, or did you kind of just fall into it?
It was good old-fashioned networking at its finest. I kind of fell into it. I was working at local law enforcement back in hometown in Tennessee, and there was a gentleman that used to do background investigations for the FBI, came in on a regular basis and did business with me at the police department. And he said, you know, I really love your customer service. I love the way that you're always so warm and welcoming, so I think Bureau can use people like you. And he invited me to apply, and the rest is history.
So where in the Bureau did you work? Because as with most people, you probably didn't get hired in one location and stay there your whole career.
That is correct. I was hired and processed in the Knoxville field office, where I spent the majority of my career in various positions, kind of worked my way up from the bottom up, did a stint as an intel analyst for a while, then worked my way into public affairs. Was fortunate enough that we bounced from Knoxville to Canberra, Australia. Spent about 3 years there from 2012 to 2015, and then we landed here in Huntsville. Been there and then retired out of the Huntsville office after 21 years of service.
And so I assume that led to your current position with the National Cybersecurity Operations Center.
That is correct. So my unusual path that I took, kind of like you, I didn't work it from the investigative side, but my skill set from coming out of Knoxville in the public affairs has certainly served me well in the role that you and I share today as part of that outreach and education team at the CSOC, and it influenced me, I think, to contribute to that landscape from that vantage point more so than from the investigative. But my FBI career did have a couple of cyber high points back in the day. When I was the public affairs officer in Knoxville, I mentioned before, I was in charge of that when the Sarah Palin email hacking took place. So that was kind of my first little sidebar with cyber, working with those agents in terms of the investigative team before and during the trial. So that was an educational experience for me.
Let's stop for that for a second. That's an interesting point. I forgot all about the Sarah Palin email. So for those who don't remember, in 2008, I used to always tell this story doing presentations because it was fascinating, because it was a cyber crime with no real hacking. So I'll let you give your rendition of it as far as like who did it, because the reason it was in Knoxville is because it was a Tennessee 17-year-old who hacked her email. But tell us about the Sarah Palin hacking case, because that's always a fascinating expose on the simplicity of social engineering and how open source research can lead to some bad things.
Correct. And I think that was the shocking part, that especially where she was, in that she was currently, you know, running for office, and there was so much information. And I think this was before cyber. I mean, I know cyber's always been around, but it's never been as prevalent as it is today. And so it was interesting in that he was able to determine all of her security questions and then the answers through just online research. And yes, he was a student at the University of Tennessee at the time. I think he was a juvenile at the time, if I remember correct. So that made it a little bit harder. I can't remember if he was or not. He actually might have not been 17. I can't remember his age. But anyway, yeah, it made for an interesting, because the campaign was ongoing. But yeah, everything that he did was available open source. So technically, you know, that starts to get into that area of, was it technically, as you mentioned, a hacking?
Right. So he got into her Yahoo email by answering a couple of security questions. One, where'd you meet your husband? And what's the zip code of the town you live in? And according to his interview that was made publicly available, because I read this online myself, I might have read it on Wikipedia, so take it for whatever truth that may say. But he said that he went to, so the question was, what's the zip code of the town you live in? And Wasilla, Alaska has two zip codes. The first one he tried didn't work. The second one he tried did. And he was got into her email.
Correct. And I think that young man passed away about a year, 2 years ago.
Really?
But it certainly was an interesting case. Yes, he is no longer with us, that I'm sure. Huh. But yes, that was my first foray into kind of watching that in action and realizing, wow, maybe I should really start to follow my own advice and some of this advice that they're giving out on this cybersecurity. This might become a thing.
And probably little did you know that a short 12 years later, you would be the North Alabama president of the Women in Cybersecurity. So tell us how you got involved with WESIS and then what exactly WESIS is and what its mission statement is.
Sure. So I got involved with WESIS in May of this year, of course, right after I retired from the FBI, graduated from the FBI, retired from the FBI. And I went over to the CSOC and joined you, and I became aware of just the challenges, or rather than challenges, I should probably say disparity of the number of women working in the field compared to the number of men working in the field. And that's really what kind of motivated me to start researching these types of organizations, either local to Alabama or one on a national level, that were really trying to empower women and kind of inspire them who were maybe on the fence about whether getting into the field or whether expanding their career with all the vacancies that you hear so much about. And then I suspected this would foster those opportunities and complement some of the great work that's already being done by all these women before me, whether it be here at local or national level. And that's what I found in WESIS. They allowed me to open that, establish the affiliate here in Northern Alabama, and then still support at the national level as well.
Yeah, that's, as I was doing some research leading up to this podcast, I found a survey by the International Information System Security Certification Consortium. Say that five times fast. And this particular survey dealt with women working in cybersecurity, and currently about 24% of the overall cybersecurity workforce is women. But that's a significantly higher finding than the survey they did in 2017, where only 11% of the respondents were women. A couple of the other stats they had on this, just for us for this discussion, is compared to men, there's a higher percentages of women cybersecurity professionals that are reaching positions such as chief technology officer, vice president of IT, IT director, C-level executive. And this shows that women are forging a path into management, not just getting into cybersecurity more, but actually going into management as well at a much higher rate than men necessarily are from the time they get into the cybersecurity field. And it's interesting because obviously the cybersecurity field, by the end of next year, I believe there'll be, 2 million empty cybersecurity jobs nationwide, because people just can't fill the roles because people aren't going into the field. And this is a great field for everybody to go into. So, you know, what are some ways that WESIS works to empower women to get into this field that historically been male dominated?
Yes, and you're right. So it depends on whatever number estimate you listen to about what the actual vacancies are. And I agree. And it doesn't matter which source you look at. There's hundreds of thousands, right? Like the number is large. And so where WESIS comes into play, so I'll back up for just a second in terms of asking about what WESIS was. They came along in 2014 through when Dr. Amberine Siraj had the National Science Foundation grant. And she hosted the first National Women's Cybersecurity Conference, not really sure what to expect. Fast forward to 2018, when she actually had so much interest and membership was almost doubling yearly, to where she was able to turn that into a 501c3, which then was able to open up different paths, different avenues, and a whole new audience to be able to engage these females that you're talking about to bring them into this field. So then you fast forward to today, there's 5,000 members. It's split. And what's unique about WESIS is it's split about 50% with professional women and about 50% with students, spread across student chapters and then professional affiliates. So through this, they offer all these resources for women, and primarily you would engage through a professional affiliate or through a student chapter, and then that's going to lead you and the women that join to these more needs-based communities. So we have the communities such as the speaker community, the veterans community, the mentor-mentee community, and then the allies and advocates community. And all of those are more geared, and they all support that core mission of building that strong gender diverse cybersecurity workforce. And they facilitate not only recruitment, but retention and advancement for women in the field. And so I think that's one thing that, you know, they do a great job of in the 7 years they've been in existence and change. They've got over 3.5 million in industry support. You've got 6,400 attendees that go to the national conference every year. It is the largest women in cybersecurity conference in the nation. They've had 3,000 student scholarships awarded, faculty grants. There's about 340 of those, and then 26 veteran fellowship awards.
Wow, that is fantastic. So a couple other stats that came out of the survey that generally women are more educated and younger in the cybersecurity field than men. 44% of men hold a postgraduate degree, while women, it's 52%. Nearly half of the women surveyed are millennials, 45% compared to 33%. And by contrast, Gen X men make up the bigger percentage of the workforce and women. That's the one area that the men have a higher percentage in women. But based on these stats, what do you think has changed as far as women becoming more involved in the cybersecurity field?
Well, I think you're starting to see, you know, hopefully that's changed. Obviously, it's up from that 11% you mentioned up to the 24%. But you're starting to see females, you know, emerging in that at that C-suite level. I mean, you look at Manisha Ghosh as the Federal Commission Communications Commissioner. You've got women in industry leading at companies like Nest and Starbucks and Stitch Fix. And so you look at these women, and not only you look at them from the diversity standpoint of skill set and diversity, what traditionally means diversity, but it's even in their backgrounds and their education level. And as you say, it's interesting to watch the stats that when you look at some that you just quoted, that the education level of the women is actually higher than the educational of the men. So it's going to be interesting to see where that takes us in another 10 years and what those stats look like.
So how do women who are currently in the cybersecurity field, either in Huntsville or elsewhere, or those that wish to be in the field, get started with WESIS? And if they become involved with WESIS, what are some of the benefits to joining WESIS? How much networking is there? I assume that's the biggest piece is networking, but talk a little bit about that, you know, if there's any females listening that never heard of WESIS before, how do they get involved and what's the process?
So the easiest way is to go right to the website, to www.wesis.org. That's the quickest place that you can join. I will tell you, the website that they have out there was their original website. So good news, keep your eyes on the website. There's a brand new website hopefully launching in October, November timeframe. They can look up, they can pull down the drop-down menu, and it will tell them whether there's a local affiliate in their region. Like I said, that right now there's 107 different student chapters across the U.S. and international, and then there's 28 professional affiliates all across 30 states in the U.S. So hopefully there's one close enough. Right now we're the only affiliate in Alabama, but there is a rumor that the ladies down in central Alabama may want to get together and form their affiliate. So there's a lot of good work going on. And then there's women that they can get involved with that are at various stages of their career. And the one thing I think for me that stands out about WESIS is we kind of take them through that full cycle. They can come to us as students, you know, as young as high school if they want to start to engage with WESIS. Then we can continue to mentor them through their college years, and then they can turn into our professionals. So you really, these women can be involved and can continue to grow throughout their entire career, which is something that I don't know that the other organizations offer. There's lots of great organizations out there, but WESIS is very unique in the way that they offer that full cycle from start to finish if you choose.
So I know that you've prepped for quite a few webinars for WESIS, and what are some of the upcoming topics? How do folks get involved if they want to participate in them? Is there a cost? Is it free? How does that all work?
So there is never a cost to attend a WESIS event for us or any other affiliate once you become a member. All the membership rates are out there on the site. We have varies from professional memberships to students to veterans to faculty. So all that information is on the website. But for us here, the local events that we have coming up on September 23rd, we've got Matt Dunn who from Kroll. He's going to speak a little bit about incident response and COVID-19's impact on cybersecurity. And, of course, our mutual friend Scott Augenbaum, who I heard you on the episode a few weeks back, did a great job. He's also going to be coming up for us on October 28th to talk just about cybersecurity in general, talk about his tips and tricks, share some great stories, kind of like he did with you. Of course, we're going to try to do a couple other events with some of our partner agencies, and that's something, you know, I want to make sure to mention that Women in Cybersecurity also has a lot of great partnerships, and we're fortunate here in North Alabama to do the same. So we'll do some partner events for the National Cybersecurity Awareness Month coming up in October, as you are well aware. And then Rhonda Sutton, with our AUSA chapter, our former colleague, she's got a great veterans outreach event coming up in November. And then hopefully, fingers crossed, maybe we can actually have some sort of holiday event in December. And then we've got several speakers in the works for this coming spring. And then at the national level, you can look on the website at thewesis.org. There's all kinds of great events coming up. They just wrapped up the virtual career fair. They've got all kinds of AWS workshops. They've got certificates, all of that once you have access to the member portal as a member. And then I'm going to do a shameless plug for the upcoming the summit next March, because, of course, last March, COVID kind of took care of that. But everybody mark their calendars, March 25th through 27th of 2021 in Denver will be the next conference. And that registration is going to open up pretty soon. So I encourage you to check that out and try to join us out in Denver in March.
Great. So open up your crystal ball and predict the future for women in cybersecurity.
Ooh, crystal ball. Let's see. I guess if I had to choose one word, I would say the future is bright. No, let me change that. I think the future is limitless. How about that? Let's go with limitless. I think the number of vacant positions that you talked about earlier, that, like you said, we talked varied on the source, the message the same. There are going to be vacancies, and I think it's really just going to be up to each individual woman how far she wants to take that. I mean, it's really just a matter of supply and demand. As we talked about earlier, you know, there's more women with postgraduate degrees, and these women really are the future of cybersecurity. And by taking these younger, more educated women and then pairing them with the female visionaries that we have in our field. Like I said, I mentioned Dr. Shiraj as WESIS. You've got the Girls in Tech program, Girls Who Code, the Gen Cyber programs they've got going on at Dakota State. All of these great programs have all been launched by women. They're all being led by visionary women in the field. And I think by creating these organizations, these strategic partnerships, we are building that workforce, or at least we're making steps to build that workforce of qualified women for years to come. And I think it was Arianda Huffington that said, the strongest, most fearless women are the most creative and productive, and they are the ones who want to support other women.
Great. So I am going to throw you two curveballs, which you weren't expecting this, okay. But I just kind of came to me as we were talking. But the first one is, I know you're very active with a friend of yours with Girls Who Shoot. So talk a little bit about that. I think that's very interesting. Has nothing to do with cyber, but it's still interesting. So
it does not have to do with cyber, but you know what? It's along the same. It all comes back to empowering women. So I am actually a great part of an organization called Shoot Like a Girl. It's actually a business, but it's also an organization by a retired Army friend of mine, Karen Butler, who owns that. And she teaches women all about firearm safety, about how to feel comfortable with a firearm. And it really is about, you know, making them be comfortable and being safe as women so they can protect themselves. And it also gets them involved with outdoor shooting sports. And so empowering them to be able to do that, that's another kind of male dominated field historically. And so it's the same message, just different subject.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. That's awesome. Now, so the last curveball is, your last position with the FBI was here in Huntsville, dealing with the transfer of personnel from FBI headquarters in DC down to the Huntsville campus. And I know, like me, you get a lot of people that say, hey, I hear there's 5,000 people coming. How do I get a job with the FBI? So you were much more involved with the headquarter component to that moving to Huntsville, because I was part of the local field office, so not so much involved. But talk a little bit about that, because I'm assuming that since this podcast is created in Huntsville, most of the folks that listen probably are here. Hopefully at some point it'll branch out. But
We're going for national.
Right. So, awesome. Yeah, but people who live elsewhere can move to Huntsville, should they choose to do so. Except the housing market is crazy, because it's hard to find a house from what I understand. So that's why I haven't sold mine. But give a little bit about what the FBI is trying to do in moving the personnel to to Huntsville, what is coming? Do you know what's coming? Do you know what units or sections are coming and when? What does that look like? And if someone is interested in being hired by the FBI, what is kind of that process? I know right now my son is a senior at UAH, and he just tonight sent me his resume to look over because he's applying for some of the jobs that they're looking to fill here. His fiance got a job a year ago. So, and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I'm since I graduated in
retired, not graduate.
Since I retired, I keep your son graduated. Since I retired this spring, I'm not in the know anymore of exactly which divisions are coming down. You know, when I did retire, there was about 16 different divisions represented over on the arsenal, and I think those transfers and relocations of positions are still continuing here in Huntsville. I'm excited to kind of see what they do with the building and what they do with some of that. But I do know that, you know, they kind of took a step back and said, where are those synergies here in Huntsville and things that we're doing in Washington, D.C. that would align? And as you know, Huntsville is a very forward-thinking, a very technical town, and a lot of talent and a lot of really, you know, educated and, you know, motivated folks here in Huntsville. And I think they've been very warm and welcoming to the FBI. I think that will continue. I do think that if people want to get involved, and the best way to keep up with what jobs are available and is to get themselves set up on FBIjobs.gov. A lot of people in this town, they still go to USA Jobs. And, you know, the FBI, as you know, got away from USA Jobs a few years back. And so our positions are posted only on FBIjobs.gov. Right now, two of the big things that are going on is the internship is open until September 30th. And then they've also opened up the Collegiate Hiring Initiative. So like your son, I would encourage him to do it through the Collegiate Hiring Initiative. Those are direct hires. They're looking for specialties. That you don't have to necessarily have a degree in cyber. I think that's a little bit of the misinformation that's out there. You can have a degree in any field. They're looking for those core competencies, whether it's leadership, whether it's initiative, whether it's, I mean, it can be anything from political science to cyber, of course, but they, you know, there's a place for you if you're willing to kind of work hard and learn the organization. And as you know, you had multiple, I'm sure, positions throughout your career as well as I did. So you can start out in one. Don't be afraid to start an entry-level position and then just, you know, work your way up through the program, continue your education. And I think within the Bureau, it's kind of the same. The sky's the limit if you want to continue and explore what those options are.
And the most important point for anyone applying for the FBI is be patient. It is not a quick process.
Unfortunately, it was already a slow process. And I guess any of the federal government, you know, it took, I don't know how long it took you, but it took me almost a year from start to finish to complete the process. And that's when you didn't have a COVID environment. So I do think that, you know, they're having some of the same challenges as every, you know, company and agency that's out there right now. I know they're all, you know, working diligently to get them processed. But I do think it goes back to the old saying of no news is good news. So, you know, until they tell you you are no longer being considered, you just need to assume that you are still being considered and you're still working your way through that pipeline.
Right. Because I plan to do a podcast at some point about how to get a job in the FBI, or specifically an agent job or a cyber, you know, if you want to be in cyber. But that's the key part there is, even though you may not have heard about your job, but if they told you they're going to hire you, as long as they haven't sent you or contacted you and said we're no longer interested, the process is ongoing. It's just not a quick process. So just
that's right. I always tell them, because I will have folks reach out and say, hey, can you check on this? And I'm like, look, have you heard anything to the contrary? And if they say no, then I'm like, no news really is good news in this case. That is a good thing.
Right, right. So how do people get in touch with you, Stacey? If they have interest in WESIS, how do they contact you or contact WESIS itself?
So our presence really relies on our social media pages. So I'd love to ask everybody that's listening to the podcast today, even if you decide that you don't want to be a member with us, I would love for you to keep up, support us, be an ally for us. We've got our LinkedIn page, the Women in Cybersecurity Northern Alabama affiliate. You can also find the national page, just Women in Cybersecurity, and all the national events. That is one thing I neglected to mention, is that anytime you join the national level, you can attend any affiliates. And right now, any affiliates event, right now with the COVID, most of them are virtual. So it's kind of, for us, there's a little bit of silver lining in that historically, like take me, for example, if I wanted to attend, you know, a Silicon Valley event or a North Carolina event, I have to be there in person, but now they're all online and virtual. So you can cross pollinate between affiliates and you can attend any of those events. You just got to compensate for those time zones. But we also have our Facebook page, same Women in Cybersecurity Northern Alabama affiliate, and we also have an Instagram page. So all of our events are announced there. All of our events are hosted, and you can register through Eventbrite. So you can go on there. You'll get your confirmation and your link to join our virtual calls. And like I said, then we're really hoping by spring we'll be able to have some in-person events.
Great. And you can find Stacy on LinkedIn as well. Spell your name for him, Stacy.
So it's Stacy with an IE and then Bohannon, very phonetic, just Bohannan.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. And I guess we'll see you tomorrow at work.
I'll see you tomorrow at work.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
As always, I want to thank you for listening to the Cyber Guy podcast. If you have any questions you'd like me to address on future podcasts or topics you'd like to hear, email me at Darren@thecyberguy.com. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R. Darren is spelled D-A-R-R-E-N. If you like this podcast, please feel free to leave a review on your favorite podcast service. If it allows you to do so, please tell your friends if you think it would be something that would be valuable for them to listen to. My goal here, as always with this podcast, is to educate folks to keep them safe. As you progress through your week, make sure you understand the cyber threats that are facing you, assess your overall cyber risk, and proceed wisely. Have a good week.